We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. This is episode 3, A Very Hairy Christmas. Thanks for joining us at Potterversity. The holiday season is upon us, and today Emily Strand and I will talk with Dr. Beatrice Groves about Christmas in the Harry Potter series. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions at Mount Carmel College and author of several Harry Potter essays.
Today's topic, Emily, is A Very Hairy Christmas, which I have shamelessly stolen as a title from Dobby's banner in the Room of Requirement in Book 5.
Forgot about that. Good reference. That's not stealing. That's illusion.
Anytime I can bring Dobby in, I'm going to try to do that. And I feel like this year, as a balm to some of our 2020 experiences, we're all just a little more keen to bring on the holiday spirit.
Bring it.
Whether that's Christmas or one of the other holidays of this season. And so, for example, I'm trying to think of ways I can bring in the holiday spirit to my family, even though we're not going to be traveling anywhere, doing some of the kind of typical things we do for the season. So one of the things I've decided we're going to try to do is do a Zoom gingerbread house crafting.
Oh, that's a good idea.
And everybody have their own gingerbread house, and we'll just Zoom and craft together what we would normally be doing in person. And so I thought that was sort of a way we could simulate some of the normal holiday spirit. What are you doing, Emily? What are your holiday go-tos this year?
Well, you know, we are in the midst of Advent right now, and Advent in the Catholic tradition has its own sort of traditions. And so there's a lot of really wonderful Advent music. And since I'm a church musician, we're kind of in the throes of preparing a lot of music for church. So there's a lot of music. I can't say we're doing anything terribly special right now. We're starting to get some of the Christmas decorations out, some of the more subtle Christmas decorations out, the blues and the purples, that sort of thing. And we're preparing a lot of music. But otherwise, it's pretty chill around here with regard to Christmas. We get really gung-ho on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, and then it kind of explodes from there. And everybody else is like, we go out and we're like so excited about Christmas, and then we see like people's trees at the curb and stuff like that, which is really, we're on just kind of a different schedule than most people, but it's really fine with us. It makes us feel special.
So that's funny. You mentioned the Advent season, and I think that is one of the things that kind of gives a pace to the Christmas season. And I was thinking when I was, you know, contemplating this show and this topic, when I read the books, I thought of them as just kind of cycling through various phases of the school year, and the Christmas holiday was just like a calendar milestone that gave the reader a sense of the passage of time and the academic year. Of course, I'm always thinking about the academic year. It's the holiday season. It's winter break. So I think that's interesting, right, that you have that sense that there are certain things like, you know, and now it's, now it's Halloween, and now it's Christmas, and now it's Easter. They're these kind of calendar milestones. And today we're going to particularly talk about not just how Christmas is figuring in as like a marker of time, but the significance of Harry's Christmases. That's our theme for today. And our special guest for this episode is Dr. Beatrice Groves, fellow and tutor at Oxford University and author of the rich treasure trove of a book, Literary Illusion in Harry Potter. If you don't have that book, you need to get that book. Her MuggleNet.
I keep mine within grabbing distance at all times.
It's wonderful. There's so many things. Whenever I start a new topic, I'm like, did Bea say anything about this? Because she says something about almost everything. There's so many wonderful references there. Bea's MuggleNet blog is Batilda's Notebook, and she also blogs at Leaky Cauldron. Listeners, you can also follow her on Twitter. Welcome to Potterversity, Bea.
Hi, both of you. Lovely to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me and for your very kind words about my book.
It's all true. It's all true.
Absolutely. So, Bea, tell us, when did you first notice the importance of Christmas imagery to the major themes of the Harry Potter books?
Well, I think just like you, for most of it, I didn't. I just thought of it as, part of the pleasures of the Christmassiness, that she was just enjoying that as a marker. And really, it wasn't until Deathly Hallows and the sense of a very different Christmas, the first time we really see a church in the series, the light falling out of the church, the music of the carols washing over them as they're in the snow, and then reading biblical verses, you think, okay, this is quite different from everything we've had up to this point. And then also reading John Granger's Deathly Hallows lecture, he mentions how this is a man and a woman, because Harry and Hermione take Polyjuice to appear as a man and a woman, going back to the man's place of birth on Christmas Day. And I thought, oh yeah, he's right. That is very first Christmas, Mary and Joseph returning to Bethlehem, his place of birth, on Christmas Day, the first Christmas Day. And I thought that is very striking as a parallel. So that made me think about how she uses Christmas days beforehand. But there's a lovely phrase that Lev Grossman used in his review of Deathly Hallows, where he said, you know, one moment I'd finished it, I then wanted to go back and read the whole series again in the light of what I now knew. And I thought that Christmas works that way as well for After Deathly Hallows.
Yeah, that's right. That's a great little, it's a microcosm of what you experience from the whole book, but it shows you that there's been important foundation laid even before you get to that point. Emily, I know you've also written about Christmas imagery in the Harry Potter series. When did you first start to think about its larger significance?
You know, I think I've played with it a lot, kind of in a passing way, in a lot of the things I've written, because I've written a lot about the Christian symbolism and the Christian meaning in Harry Potter. And of course, you know, Christmas and incarnational theology, the incarnational theology is our theology of God becoming man in Jesus Christ, or God becoming human in Jesus Christ. So I've played with it a lot, you know, along the way. But then, Katie, it was when we interviewed for Reading, Writing, Rolling, we interviewed Maria Sachikosa-Siri about her book that was out last year, Reenchanted. A great book, by the way.
Very good.
Great interview, too. That was a really fun episode of Reading, Writing, Rolling. So everybody go back and listen to that. So she talked a lot about Christmas in children's fantasy literature as this sort of bridge between the mundane and the magical. And I think Christmas, and not just in these stories, but in popular culture as well, Christmas really has these associations of sort of infusing our mundane world with magic all of a sudden in this bleak midwinter, time, that all of a sudden we have this sort of magic that we can tap into. And the idea of, you know, the attractiveness of believing in that magic, even not just for children, but even for adults as well. And so that really got me thinking about Narnia, and it got me thinking about Christmas and Harry Potter. And, you know, like, how do you convey extra special magic in a world that's already thoroughly magical? And Rowling seems to use Christmas as this way of sort of amping up the magic at these really important times. And she also seems to use it to point to the most important or what she calls the deepest magic of her universe, which is this idea of love being stronger than all other forces of the universe, including death. And so that, you know, I've just kind of started my journey. So I was really excited to be able to read Bee's work in the last couple of Christmases on Christmas. And so I don't know, I'm just getting started with this topic. So I'm really excited about our conversation today.
Yeah, I agree with you that interview and reading that chapter in Reenchanted about Christmas in fantasy novels was very illuminating. And I hadn't really thought about it. And so that sort of, it cast this light on the Christmases of the Harry Potter series that does make you want to go back in and talk about each of them and to find those things that maybe appeared to be hidden. That's what J.K. Rowling does so skillfully. Mm-hmm. She hides little things in, and you think you're just, you know, reading something episodic or this is just a little funny anecdote, but it turns out to have some larger significance. And so I'm definitely excited to get a chance to see how some of those foundations are laid. So Harry doesn't get to go home for the holidays, though we might argue that Hogwarts is actually more his home than the Dursleys' house. And I do believe he signs himself up to stay for Christmases at Hogwarts. Yes.
I think that's really important, Katie, that he does stay home for the holidays. So maybe this is one of those signs of how much Hogwarts is his home, which she doesn't stress until later. It's really Deathly Hallows again. So in Deathly Hallows, there's a point where Harry is home at last when he returns to Hogwarts. And it says he was home. Hogwarts was the first and best home he had known.
Mm-hmm.
And both of those, mm-hmm. those are both in Deathly Hallows. So it's only in Deathly Hallows that she explicitly comes out and says this is his home.
Yeah.
But the fact that he's basically until book five always been at Hogwarts for Christmas is perhaps a nice little, and always been happy to be there, never felt, oh no, I'm, you know, staying here against my will, that's a little, again, a little signifier that it is his home.
Do you think that his celebration of the holiday at Hogwarts is a part of it becoming his home? Is that what makes it home for him?
I do think so. And notice the first time he spends Christmas away from Hogwarts is the first time Hogwarts doesn't feel like home, which is when Umbridge is in charge.
Oh, right. Yeah, so he actually says that. He's just, yeah. He needs to be away because of all of that.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, that Burrow is the other place that's his home. And so it's right that he spends a Christmas at the Burrow in six. That's a nice sort of parallel. But I think the first one away is a signal of the way that Hogwarts has shifted in Phoenix.
Let's talk about how Rowling makes use of Harry's school experience of the Christmas holiday, which is kind of unusual. I mean, most of us are not spending the winter holiday in our school environment. How does she make use of this, whether it's building that sense of home or a sense of community for Harry? What are some of the key parts of that?
I think, so one of the things is, I suppose, to make it very communal. So that there's a sort of this wider family aspect. Most people's Christmases are quite insular in a family way, and to have that much wider sense. And I think that that's an important, again, an early key marker of a Christian idea in the series is in Azkaban, when at Christmas Day the tables are put aside, and Dumbledore says, you know, we're not going to sit on house tables. We're going to all just sit on one table together.
Yes, and I was thinking about, you know, when Harry even wakes up that first Christmas and, you know, finds that he has presents, you know, Ron is also there in the room with him. And it is all of the things that are described have this kind of feel of, you know, he's there with other people, although it's a smaller group than normal. It is still a community. He's not just isolated in his Christmas.
I was thinking about the different years, and you know, Rowling has to do some kind of narrative and character acrobatics to get Ron there with him. You know, I mean, it's always like, oh well, my parents are going to, you know, wherever to visit some older sibling. You know, I mean, I can't remember the details of it, but she kind of, it's kind of like, that's one of the least believable things to me, is that somebody like Ron would be staying behind at school for Christmas, you know, when he's got this lovely family. And so I kind of got into a little reverie thinking about what she has to do to get Ron to be there with Harry. Is he there every year with Harry, or there are just certain years?
No, it's always there. Yeah.
That's so funny.
Which is, yeah, as you say, not overly convincing.
Right. It's just like so not likely. I mean, my family is a lot like Ron's family, you know, so it's like we would never even think about being at school for Christmas, even if our best friend was like the hero of the universe.
So I, yeah, I think she does. She has to do these acrobatics to get the community there at the school. But then she really reinforces it in the kinds of scenes that she describes. I mean, she's got the Weasley twins throwing snowballs off of Quirrell's turban, right? In
Oh
the,
my
I think that
God.
might be before they everybody goes home, but like that's 'tis the Christmas season. So she, you know, she's building that sense of community. Are there other things that become, you know, part of this school style experience of Christmas? It's not a family holiday exactly,
I think it's interesting that he gets to see the staff sort of let down their hair. You know, I mean, you get to see the staff and
that's
your
nice.
teachers in a totally new light, you know, and they're in this mood for celebration. And I mean, Dumbledore is always a little bit silly, but he gets particularly silly at Christmas. And that seems to be sort of a bonding.
It's the only time we see McGonagall let her hair down at all, isn't it? There's
Right.
a sort of joke in the Yule Ball where she says, "This is a chance for us to let our hair down," and everyone is thinking, "You're definitely not going to let your hair down." But there is an earlier one where she gets a little bit tipsy, and I think, is it Hagrid kisses her and she looks quite pleased? That is the only time that happens.
Moments that did not make it into the films.
Yeah, and like Dumbledore, where, you know, they do the Christmas crackers, you know, and Dumbledore puts on a bonnet. It's just, you know, with a little bonnet on his head. I think there are these things that are kind of like when you see your teacher in a social environment and you're like, oh, like you're an actual human being.
Right. Always odd. I would love to get to some of these things. I mean, I hope I'm not jumping the gun here, but I would love to get to some of these. Katie made an allusion to these little things that happen in and around and on Christmas in the series that you sort of don't notice for more than their either comedic value or just sort of plot value, but they actually turn out to be rich in symbolism for Christmas. I would love to hear B talk a little bit about some of those things. What are some of the important things that happen on Christmas Day in ho at Hogwarts, and what do they mean?
So I think one of the most important things is Christmas gifts. So two crucial gifts. He gets the invisibility cloak in the first one and the firebolt in the third one. And those are two gifts that really resonate, and that obviously the invisibility cloak will become a hallow eventually. The first one, he also sees the mirror of Erised for the first time on Christmas Day. That sense of both your heart's desire, so both something that's really something you really desire, but also the sort of possible dangers of that. I think that's a really exciting one. And it links back to what Katie was saying about family, that what he thinks there, what he sees is his family. What he desires is to be with his family, which I suppose is a very Christmas-related idea, but it's part of his hero's journey to move from the sort of safe family environment out into, you know, being the sort of singular hero. But the one that's really the most Christian, when you look back on it, you go, oh yeah, that really works, is the Polyjuice Potion in two, that they take Polyjuice Potion for the first time on Christmas Day, in Chamber. And Rowling's talked about the way in which she's thought really carefully about the ingredients of Polyjuice, and they've all kind of, she says, each one's carefully selected. She's got lacewing flies, and she talks about the way in which each one. So there's Boomslang skin, again, so the skin that comes off a snake. And knotweed knotting the two identities together. And when you read her writing about that, you think, yes, she is thinking about the fact that at the incarnation, two identities, the divine and the human, get knotted together in this sort of, you know, obviously way we can't quite understand. But that makes taking Polyjuice Potion, where two identities come together on Christmas Day, a really subtle, but I think definitely present allusion to the Christmas idea, of the sort of incarnational idea.
But then Hermione turns into a cat.
It can all go wrong.
I don't think the cat is relevant.
Yeah, my cats think that a fusion of cat and human is an important Christmas miracle. My cats are quite happy to become one with the lap. I'm interested in the invisibility cloak as a gift as well, because, you know, as you say, it's a hallow, and it's one of the hallows that is coming down through Harry's own family. So although it passes through Dumbledore, it's really a gift from his father. And how interesting to have the Mirror of Erised, which is portrayed as this kind of illusion of family, in contrast to the actual gift from his father's family, from the Potters, this invisibility cloak that represents a sort of proper management of one's response to death, as we see at the very end in the Deathly Hallows with the Tale of the Three Brothers.
And the mirror is also, you know, it's a crucial part of, it's not exactly the proper response to death, but the other thing that Harry manages, that his sort of heroism in the end is partly his ability to have, you know, as you call it, the response to death, which it allows him to die for his friends, but also the fact that he sees in the mirror what will benefit other people. So initially his first moment is the family, but what he's going to see in the mirror is stopping Voldemort getting the stone.
Right.
And Dumbledore stresses that later. He says, you know, do you not know how extraordinary it is that you were able just to see something which is of benefit to other people, as that is your deepest desire? The fact that he sees the Mirror of Erised on Christmas Day points us forward towards the way in which that's going to be a crucial part of his heroism.
Really, the cloak has to be part of any conversation about Christmas and about incarnational theology in Harry Potter, because, you know, I was sitting in a class. Actually, I had a guest speaker for some of my students, and this was when I was at University of Dayton, and the guest speaker was saying to my students, she was talking about the notion of Christian grace, and she was saying, you know, we were in a Catholic context, so she was kind of saying, well, there's this one theory of grace. It's more of a Protestant theory, but it's interesting. She says this theory of grace that grace is like a cloak that covers the believer and sort of protects the believer from, you know, the stains of the human condition of mortality and sin and all this stuff. And like, I'm
cloak.
Sitting in the back of the, yeah, I'm sitting in the back of the classroom and my eyes are like saucers, you know, and she's like, what? I'm like, you know, I told her later, I was like, I was having these Harry Potter moments all over the place. And so I've always, ever, that was years ago. And ever since, I've always read the cloak as this metaphor for, you know, sort of like what Katie was saying about this properly managed response to death. I mean, death, you know, doesn't go away for us mortals, but we have, you know, in the Tale of the Three Brothers, we see how we have this option to sort of live our lives anyway, you know, and to go through life and with certain sort of protections and certain coverings that keep us safe from death. And so I've always been intrigued by the role, how Harry gets the cloak on Christmas and how significant this is to our understanding of incarnational theology, which does sort of cover the human race, you know, in our theological tradition. It covers the human race with a grace that allows for full union with God. Just some Christmassy thoughts, you know, and incarnational thoughts about the cloak.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is the religious significance of all of these things. And when I was reading through, you know, and not really thinking much about these Christmases, you know, I mostly saw some of the secular, you know, pieces, like the Christmas crackers, you know, and I didn't necessarily think about the, you know, the way that there is a kind of religious element to all of those things.
To fit in with your grace thing, of course, there's a, you know, strong medieval imagery of Mary of Mercy, where she brings everyone under her cloak. I don't know if you know those images. That's quite a nice one of sort of cloak of grace. But I was thinking that what Dumbledore says about the cloak as being the most important hallow is that is you can share it with other people. So this is the one where, you know, you can bring your under it, and that's why it's above the other hallows.
Yeah, you know, I think I was thinking about how when in the Order of the Phoenix he's not at Hogwarts, there are still some elements of Christmas that do make it feel like Christmas to him. And it's again, it's a part of that sense of community. And once again, he's with the Weasley kids. So, you know, that's a constant.
Hermione, again, she makes a little effort. So Hermione's meant to be away skiing, and when she hears what's happened, she comes back so that Hermione is as well. And there's a lovely thing, and I thought it's very much. I really like that one for this year because I think we have a new sympathy with Sirius this year. The idea that he's stuck in one house all year, and for most of us, you
So
know,
true.
that's not something we've really realised until this year. I mean, suddenly, God, poor Sirius, stuck alone in this house all year on his own, and he's so happy that they're there. And Harry says, you know, but Sirius is happier than he's ever known him, because he's so glad they're all there with him for Christmas. And there's a beautiful thing again with the carols. So I've written about the way that carols are kind of the one of the rare explicitly Christian signifiers of Christmas throughout the series. And we hear Sirius singing a carol, and Harry is sort of in self-imposed isolation. He's sulking and he's alone, and he hears the sound of Sirius's joy, sort of, because I think it says, so like coming up through the floorboards as he's sitting alone, is the sound of Sirius singing the carol. And that is very much, I think, a sense of telling Harry to get back into the communal place, which he will manage to do for Christmas Day, mostly through Ginny, I think. I think Ginny's saying, you know, you what you're not realizing that I have actually gone through the thing that you fear you're going through, and you've forgotten that because you're so solipsistic in your sorrow. You know, you think you're the only one who suffered from Voldemort, and actually he's possessed me, so I know what this is, and you should ask me about it. And Harry has to go, oh yeah, okay. And I think that also happens on Christmas Day in five because they go to St. Mungo's, and again, sort of two of the most important people for Harry re-feeling empathy and compassion and being sort of reintegrated back in five are Neville and Luna, and the sort of realization that they have lost their parents as well. And so going to St. Mungo's and seeing Neville there and the way in which he suffered, and we've, you know, for a long time we haven't really known about it, and this is the first time we've seen it for real, and Harry gets a sort of deep feeling of this sort of the pain of feeling that empathy for Neville and realizing that he's not actually suffered as badly as Neville has.
And you know, that's Neville's Christmas every year. You know, and there's something, it's sweet, but it's so painfully sad also, what he experiences. And that's one of those moments where I think we see Neville really, the moral core of him that is so solid and strong when he talks about how he feels about his parents and their heroism.
And this is the novel where we get the sort of Neville Harry paralleling. Something which I often talk about is the chiastic form of the series, which is where one and seven are paired, two and six, and three and five. And the Neville pairing is really clever in three and five, because in three, the Neville pairing is entirely comic. So he takes Neville's name when he goes onto the night bus, and he has a dream in which Neville has replaced him on the Quidditch pitch, and it's a total disaster. And it's just the kind of, oh no, you know, how can Harry, the hero, be confused with Neville? That's just sort of comic idea. And then it comes back in five completely differently, and we see that Neville is actually been suffering more than Harry. And that Neville could have been the chosen boy, and that Neville's life has been sort of blighted by Voldemort, just like Harry's has been. And as you say, that Neville is in fact a sort of more solid moral core in some ways, in the way that we just never would have thought of in three.
Which reminds me of something that I wrote, and this has been a while, up at Hogwarts Professor about Neville and John the Baptist. Because, you know, John the Baptist is this figure in scripture who is this pointer to the Savior. And he hovers around the kind of margins of the narrative, never really taking up the center space, but constantly faithfully pointing to the real hero of the story, which is Jesus. And so, and I see parallels with that throughout Harry Potter with the way Neville is treated in the narrative. In that sense that, yes, he could have been the one. And some people, you know, in scripture thought John the Baptist was the one, but he was just constantly saying, no, it's this guy over here. Even to the point where in Deathly Hallows, when Harry has, you know, had the revelations from the Pensieve and he's on his way to the forest, he passes to Neville the task of killing the snake. Whereas, you know, in the Gospel of John, Jesus hanging on the cross passes to his faithful disciple the care of his mother, who is symbolically known to be the crusher of the snake, you know. And so you have these really wonderful, and John the Baptist is a really predominant figure in the season of Advent, which of course leads up to Christmas. And so you hear stories of John the Baptist, and he is this kind of harbinger of the Savior, who is Jesus at Christmas.
Yeah, that's really nice. And I think it's absolutely true that clearly some of the Gospels are written sort of, as it were, consciously to people who think that John the Baptist is the Messiah. Mm. So you can hear that there's a sort of, there's a movement, a John the Baptist Messiah movement, which is being repudiated in the Gospels. And that works quite well with how nearly it could have been Neville. In fact, the Neville fits exactly rightly. And in fact, because he's a pureblood, there's that slight mystery as to why Voldemort chose Harry, because Neville actually sort of fits the narrative better. And in fact, probably, you know, we think probably Voldemort chose Harry because he's more like him, because Voldemort mm-hmm. isn't blood either. But that does fit very well.
I imagine him flipping a coin. No, I'm kidding.
Why doesn't he just kill both of them? You know, think when they're
end of story.
Bit of a shift, but I was just thinking, just going back to the, you know, important things that happen on Christmas Day. Mm-hmm. So we've obviously got the Yule Ball in the center novel of the series, which obviously fits very nicely with sort of celebration and importance. And your point about the sort of communal, the whole, not just the whole school, but schools coming together, in the sense that the whole Triwizard Tournament was meant to be about cooperation among magical peoples. More generally, and that doesn't happen that much in Goblet of Fire, but the Yule Ball is the kind of center of that. But I also really like in six, or so what happens in six, that Scrimgeour visits the Burrow Christmas Day. And I think what's really important about that one is that that's the moment when Harry reasserts his faith in Dumbledore, having spent a lot of five being really you know, very full of doubt basically about Dumbledore, and that it takes the Scrimgeour visit and for him basically to say, you know, I'm Dumbledore's man through and through. And that's a really, again, a sort of expression of faith on Christmas Day works very well from the sort of Christian angle.
You know, I was sort of thinking about what you were saying with Sirius being so isolated in book five, and then all of the, you know, the decorating for Christmas and him singing. And is he singing God Rest Ye Merry Hippogriffs?
He is singing that. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is, so it's kind of a joke. And I think, you know, she does that. She hides things in jokes sometimes that then all you look at in a different way.
Almost all her jokes, you know, in fact, you could learn narrative misdirection that if she's put a joke in, then probably there's something.
Just thinking about it in terms of the Christmas carols in the series, you know, there's this passage in Goblet of Fire where they're talking about some of the ways that the school, you know, generates Christmas spirit and the ways that we're kind of used to through decorations and those kinds of things. But then the narration says, it was quite something to hear "O Come All Ye Faithful" sung by an empty helmet that only knew half the words. Several times Filch the caretaker had to extract Peeves from inside the armor where he had taken to hiding, filling in the gaps in the songs with lyrics of his own invention, all of which were very rude. So it's kind of a, you know, she kind of uses caroling and carols as a bit of a joke. You know, Dumbledore's trying to lead people through the various carols. There's a heartiness and a fun to them. But B, you've written about some of the maybe deeper significance of carols in the, you know, that are referenced in the Harry Potter series. What is the significance of some of these carols that may seem kind of like a joke at first?
Yeah, so I think obviously they are comic. The ones that we actually hear the names of, So the God Rest You Merry Hippogriffs and the Come All You Faithful. So we know, real carols behind them. We get a sort of Dumbledore leading them and a few of the favourite camels in chamber. So they're not comic in that one. Although, yeah, they become comic because Hagrid sings them too loudly because he's drunk on eggnog. But I think you do get a sense of a traditional, Christian aspect of these carols, which we know the words to. But I was connecting sort of it's with a carol that doesn't actually it doesn't come out and say this, but I was thinking of the links between one of the things that happens in Christmas Day and Deathly Hallows, which is that Hermione conjures up a wreath of Christmas roses for the Harry's parents' grave. And I think it's a very beautiful moment, and I was thinking about Christmas roses because they're not something that's really lasted in England anyway. I think they're still quite important in Germany, and they've come back a bit in England, but they're slightly forgotten. We all think of holly and mistletoe and Christmas trees, but this is another sort of really important plant marking Christmas time in the 19th and 20th centuries. And it's hellebore niger. It's a hellebore that flowers at Christmas, and flowers that come out at Christmas have always had a Christian significance. So the most famous one is the Glastonbury thorn. There's a thorn at Glastonbury that flowers at Christmas, and the monarch was always used to be sent a sheaf of those flowers, and they're traditionally that's Joseph of Arimathea's staff. When he comes to Glastonbury, he tired and he plants his staff, and then it flowers at Christmas. So Christmas flowering has always had this sacred aspect to it, and the Christmas rose is massive in a number of fairy tales and carols, which it becomes the gift that. So it says sort of there's a story of the shepherd child who's lame and is behind the other people rushing to the manger to bring presents, and the shepherd child, they're poor and they have no present to give the Christ child, and the hellebore therefore flowers at that moment in order to be a present for the shepherd child to give to the baby. And I thought this is very much what's underlying in the Bleak Midwinter, and I do wonder if Rossetti knows that story, and is she's edited out the hellebore. We don't get the Christmas rose in that hymn or in her poem, but that same sense that we are coming to the manger and we don't have anything to give the Christ child, and that's okay because all he would want is love, which is obviously a sort of flower, is that sense of it's not worth anything, but it's the desire and the love that the shepherd's child feels for the baby is what that flower is expressing. And so I was really delighted to reading up about the Christmas rose to find all these stories about it and think how suitable it is that Hermione should give that present to Harry, and she and Harry really feels, about it. He's really moved to get in. It's part of Hermione's sort of perfect friendship that she produces exactly the right gift for him there. But I'd also, because it is a hellebore, I suddenly realised that hellebores turned up before in Harry Potter. There's a draft of peace earlier on in which Harry forgets to put the hellebore into the draft of peace, and Snape is therefore very rude to him. But I thought, ah, it's one of her, all her potion ingredients are meaningful. They all work with what the potion's meant to be about. And I thought, ah, it's perfect. The hellebore, the Christmas rose, it should be in the draft of peace. That works perfectly.
I love how all those things come together, that you've got the botanical significance, the children's stories, the lore, the Christmas hymn, all of that seems to be, informing this very poignant scene that she creates at the graveyard in Godric's Hollow. And it's very much, she emphasizes the kind of Christmas idea, which, when they come into Godric's Hollow, Hermione says, "I think it's Christmas." Like, they haven't even really noted the season. They haven't had the lead up. They haven't had like the Advent markers. And so it's just here they are on Christmas Eve. And just the scene, I thought I would sort of read a little bit about it, because it brings all those ingredients of Christmas that have the foundation has been laid for. And then has that beautiful part of the story with the Christmas rose. So it says this: the singing grew louder as they approached the church. It made Harry's throat constrict. It reminded him so forcefully of Hogwarts, of Peeves bellowing rude versions of carols from inside suits of armor, of the Great Hall's 12 Christmas trees, of Dumbledore wearing a bonnet he'd won in a cracker, of Ron in a hand-knitted sweater. He should have brought something to give them, and he had not thought of it, and every plant in the graveyard was leafless and frozen. But Hermione raised her wand, moved it in a circle through the air, and a wreath of Christmas roses blossomed before them. Harry caught it and laid it on his parents' grave.
Katie.
Well, I brought myself nearly to tears just reading it again for this episode.
It always does. That's always the effect that it has on me. And I think all of these things that Bea is saying, they dovetail, all of these things you've spotted, they do sort of coalesce into this moment. And of course, they all point to this reality, whether it's the theme of the Rossetti poem of In the Bleak Midwinter, you know, and mm-hmm. other hymns that kind of have this motif of, as you said in one of your blog posts, Bea, heartful, hands empty moments in front of the Christ child that Harry's having. And it all points to the primacy of love. You know, it all points to the primacy and how unimportant everything else is, rather than just, you know, love is really all one needs to worship and adore the Christ child. And for Harry, you know, that he is given something to give them, something very beautiful, but it's because of the love and the friendship between himself and Hermione. There I go again.
Yeah. And it's also one of the things that was really pleasurable finding out about this, the history of the Christmas rose, about this moment, is that there's two stories. One is the story I've told you, and the other one is where a child has an ill parent, and they go out looking for medicine and can't find it, and they meet an angel, and the angel gives them the Christmas rose, and the Christmas rose then heals the parent, either directly or they have to take it to the Christ child to bless it, and then it heals the parent. And I thought, it means that Hermione's standing in the place of an angel here as well, which I also really like. I think, oh, that really worked.
Yeah.
And sort of just as nice evidence that Rowling might well have known these stories is that there is there's a hare that directs them, which is called Crookshanks.
Mm.
So of course. I thought, oh, maybe that's where she found the name for an animal. That was really pleasing.
Of course. Okay, and everybody bring on the Hermione as an angel memes, please.
Yeah, and I do, you know, because Hermione would think about that as the gesture, you know, and that this is a symbolic gesture that has a great deal of meaning. And it's not empty, it's not superficial, and it builds upon all of these shared notion of Christmas that Harry has gotten purely through his Hogwarts experience. And that Hermione then creates the wreath, which has this tie to the Draught of Peace, I think is just so beautiful.
So, Bea, I don't think we can conclude the episode until we talk about roosters and Christmas.
So this was the really surprising one, because you don't think roosters and Christmas, but I knew about this from my work on Hamlet. So in Hamlet, there's a bit where Christmas comes, and it's mentioned that there's an old myth that at the ghosts can't walk near Christmas because the rooster sings all night long near Christmas, and that means that it's too pure for the ghost to be around. And this is sort of slightly surprising, but I thought when I read that in Hamlet, it reminded me of a window that we have here in Oxfordshire, in Iffley Church, done by an artist called John Piper, in which each of the animals announcing the nativity do so in their own voice. So it makes the sounds of the animals echo the right words. So the crow, for example, says in hac noch day, so hac noch day, it sounds sort of crow like and that means this night. And the ox goes ooby ooby where, and the sheep goes Bethlehem Bethlehem, and the rooster starts that by going Christus Natus Est, Christ is born. Works a bit better in Portuguese. Portuguese are very keen on this, and I wonder if Rowling might have heard it there when she lived in Portugal, because their sound of it makes a bit more of a cockle sound. But have a go in Latin as well. And this is the first time we see this in England is in a 16th century wall painting. It's the first example we have of it, but it is around in ballads in the 17th century, and it does look like this is one of the ways in which Shakespeare's idea that the cockerel crowing announces Christmas is because he actually does say Christ is born. And I was thinking about that as sort of a Christmas idea of the cockerel, and there are sort of again in Spain and France and things, there are sort of cockerel. I think sometimes the midnight mass is called cockerel mass, and obviously symbolically it works because the cockerel welcomes the sun, and that obviously makes a lot of sense. But I noticed that we've got those dead roosters in chamber, and I hadn't noticed until I sort of started thinking like this that it's just before Christmas, so we get Hagrid completely covered in snow coming in carrying that dead rooster. And again, as you were saying, Katie, it's a very comic moment. You know, Hagrid gets really emotional about the fact that maybe they think that Harry has done this awful thing that the basilisk has done, and he sort of chucks the rooster around, and it's a sort of absolutely comic moment, and you kind of don't notice the fact that someone's been killing roosters. And then we discover when we see the vestry, which is what Hermione has torn that page out of. It's really a vestry, which is a medieval text about animals, which have sort of fantastical animals in them, like basilisks and unicorns. And in that we hear that the rooster is the enemy of the basilisk. And so the person calling up the basilisk has to kill all the roosters. And that just works brilliantly for this Christianization reading of animals, which vestries had. So vestries did say that roosters were the enemy of the basilisk, because the basilisk is obviously a satanic snake, and therefore the rooster has to be a sort of Christ-like symbol of something that's attacking the basilisk. So that worked very nicely, I thought, for that we hear about the roosters very close to Christmas.
And another point or two, jokes and comedic elements in Harry Potter as pointing to larger realities.
Yeah.
Or disguising them, I should say. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Always be suspicious whenever she gives a joke.
Yeah. Which is a lot.
Which is a lot, yeah.
Well, yeah.
A lot
of
lays down a lot of gingerbread crumbs.
That window sounds delightful. I love that.
It's absolutely beautiful. Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. Yeah, you should definitely, if anyone's in Oxford, the Iffley Church is an absolutely stunning church. C.S.U. Lewis used to love walking to it.
Beautiful images of that window up in that blog post on, yes. Is that one on Leaky?
Yes,
So I definitely recommend checking those out.
You know, you're talking of roosters makes me realize it's time for our final special segment of the show. And this time, in the seasonal spirit, we notice it is time for happy hour at the Three Broomsticks, where we are going to enjoy a special holiday cocktail.
Yeah, we have talked about the significance of potions and potion ingredients and their symbolism. So we figured we would present a potion for you all to enjoy this Christmas season.
And Emily, you are quite a competent mixologist and creative mixologist.
Yes, I try.
Yes.
I try. Yes, I do enjoy making such potions. I would have definitely been a potioner in the wizarding world, or just taken Madame Rosmerta's job at the Three Broomsticks. That's really what I want in life. I have a YouTube video up on my YouTube channel that folks can watch of some other potions that I created with help from friends for some themed parties we would have. So you can check those out, but I've come up with a new one Madame Rosmerta has lent us here at Potterversity, only because of the coronavirus pandemic. She has been willing to share her recipe for Pepper Up Potion. She got this recipe from healer Poppy Pomfrey, who administered it liberally to the students of Hogwarts, especially in Harry's second year when there was a spate of head colds. So this potion cures the common cold instantly and also is prized for clearing one's head, improving vision, and for the added entertainment of making steam come out your ears for hours. So do enjoy this recipe. So we'll have the full recipe in the show notes, but I'll just give you kind of the instructions here. It does make a lot, so you can have the recipe if you wish to make a smaller batch, but I'll give you the 10 cup recipe here. So you want 6 cups of water. You want to boil that in a kettle, and then you want to have on hand some peppermint or candy cane tea bags. I personally like Trader Joe's brand of candy cane tea. It's a decaffeinated green tea, so it's good for the kiddos as well. Don't put the alcohol in it for the kiddos. Okay, just saying. All right. So you boil the tea. You let the tea steep for about 10 minutes because you want a real strong peppermint flavor. Once the tea has steeped, you remove the tea bags, obviously. While the tea is steeping, you can heat 2 cups of milk. And I used 2% milk and it seemed to work fine. You could also use whole milk if you want it a little bit richer. So you heat the milk and you throw in about 1/2 cup of sugar into that milk mixture. You got to stir that constantly so that the milk does not scald. And then you want to remove the milk mixture from the heat. And we grated fresh ginger into this milk mixture. That tasted really good. And you can be nice and generous with that ginger because, you know, the peppermint flavor is going to be very strong in this. So the ginger, you need a lot of ginger to cut through. So if you like ginger, have at it. And you want to save a little bit of it for garnish. So then you pour your steaming milk mixture into the tea mixture, and then you can add 6 to 8 ounces of peppermint schnapps or your some other kind of minty liqueur. So obviously you want to leave that out if you're making this drink for people under 21 or under the legal drinking age in your country or your region. Then you want to ladle it into mugs. And you can top it, you can drink it as it is, or you can top it with foamed milk, or you could make your own whipped cream. You could even flavor the whipped cream that you make with a little bit of peppermint essence, and you garnish the top with a little bit of the sprinkled ginger, and you have a delicious pepper-up potion treat that may not cure your common cold, definitely won't cure or prevent COVID-19, public service announcement. But if you use your imagination especially, it will warm you up as you wait in joyful hope for the promised vaccine.
Yeah, you know, Emily, it was such a good recipe. I made it myself last night. I was like, we'll try it out. And I definitely would say, like, there's not like a specific amount of ginger because you just say to taste. But yeah. I would definitely say you can keep going with the ginger because I was like, surely this is enough ginger. And then I was like, when I drink it, I was like, I think I could have used more ginger. So I don't think you're really in danger of doing too much of that. And it does make a lot. And we're not really gathering together. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take it to some of my friends who we have a little cocktail fairy service. so we do like a Friday, you know, we'll sort of deliver a cocktail. And I haven't really been much in this because I'm not much of a mixologist, but it was so much fun to make this. And then honestly, it is this wonderful combination of being kind of warm and cozy. And also, you know, because of the peppermint, it is a little pepper up, you know. You do get a little you get a little perk. It was a very nice. It didn't make me sleepy. It was like it was very warming, I would say.
Yes.
So a good cocktail.
Yeah, and I think you could even use caffeinated tea if you wanted it to be a little bit more of a pick me up.
Right.
But I love the Trader Joe's decaffeinated green candy cane tea because it's got the green tea, and then when you put the ginger in the recipe. Also, you know, you've got a couple ingredients that are actually really good for colds and making you feel better in this wintry mess that at least we live in here in Ohio.
Yeah. And I think it was fun. And I put a little whipped cream on the top. I just did my little can of whipped cream on the top on my little toddy.
That works.
And it was quite delightful. I hope our listeners will enjoy making themselves a little pepper up potion, courtesy of Madame Pomfrey and Madame Rose Murta.
Cheers.
So, yeah, that's wonderful.
Cheers!
And that brings us to the end of our episode today. Thanks so much to Dr. B. Groves for being on the show with us. Thanks, B.
Thanks, B.
Thanks. Lovely. Really enjoyed speaking to you both.
Remember, listeners, you can follow B on Twitter. As Headmaster Dumbledore said on that very first Hogwarts winter break, one can never have enough socks. Another Christmas has come and gone, and I didn't get a single pair. People will insist on giving me books. Let's not forget that Dobby and Harry each gifted each other socks to their mutual delight in book 4. So from all of us at Potterversity, here's wishing your holiday is filled with warm socks and good books.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes. And be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Watch out for nargles in the mistletoe. Until next time, class dismissed.